The Tom Woods Show, episode 1241.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, don't forget my friend Bob Murphy has an amazing new book where he takes all his critiques of Paul Krugman from over the years, all these devastating smashes, and organizes them in one volume according to topic. And these are topics you want to master, and Bob will help make you the master of the universe. Check it out at ContraKrugmanBook.com, and I am the narrator of the audiobook version, and you can get that for free when you check out the Audible offer at TomWoodsAudio.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Normally, I would be speaking into a microphone with a pop filter in front of it and hooked up to a boom arm sitting at my desk. Instead, I'm lying down on the couch with just a microphone plugged into my computer, no other equipment, because I'm just exhausted. I had to actually skip the show yesterday, which is horrible to contemplate, but I'm very under the weather, and it's just led to an enormous amount of fatigue and discomfort. But I just could not let the show go 2 days without an episode. So today what I'm going to do is, in fact, I didn't even know this was available. I just dug it up the other day. I want to play for you an interview I did with Andrew Bacevich. A lot of you know who he is. In fact, I'll let the me of 2012 give you all his credentials in just a minute, but he's a great foreign policy commentator, and I interviewed him on the Peter Schiff Show when I used to be a fill-in host when Peter had that radio show, two-hour daily radio show. And he had just come out, he being Bacevich, had just come out with a book called Washington Rules that I was very fond of, so I was glad to have an opportunity to interview him. And I thought that was lost forever, and I found it the other day. And little did I know just how soon it would come in handy. So I'm going to do that for today's episode, and then my hope is that I will be back up and running. Things will be back to normal by tomorrow. So, all right, here we go. Hope you enjoy it.
Very glad to be joined by Professor Andrew Bacevich, Professor of International Relations at Boston University. It's a real privilege to talk to him. As I told you at the top of the program, he has an IQ that I would estimate somewhere in the ballpark of 511. So it'll be very helpful to talk to him about what's going on in the world today. Professor Bacevich taught at West Point and Johns Hopkins University before joining the faculty at Boston University. He's a retired career officer in the U.S. Army, and his books have been seminal works of very great importance: American Empire, The New American Militarism, The Limits of Power, and most recently, Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. He's got another book coming out next month, but having written a bunch of books myself, I know the publishers are not so keen on you talking about that till they're available for purchase. So we're going to talk about Washington Rules and maybe applying them to what's going on today. Professor Bacevich, welcome to the Peter Schiff Show.
Thanks very much, and thanks for the totally over-the-top introduction.
That's probably the highest estimate of your IQ you've gotten up to this point.
My wife would not concur.
Well, I want to dig right into this. I've recommended your book on my own website several times, Washington Rules, which is an easy book for people to read. It's not weighed down by a heavy scholarly apparatus, and it makes some very important points. Can we start off by just having you explain what you mean by the term Washington Rules?
Yeah, to the essence of the argument. The argument derives from my strongly felt view that the big truths are the ones that are staring us in the face and that we take for granted and therefore don't really notice them. And the big truths about U.S. national security policy have to do with a set of habits that have been in place since the end of World War II that define the way we address the world with our military forces, and that may once, in my view, have had merit, but no longer do. So what are those habits? Number one, we design our forces not to defend the country, but to provide instruments of global power projection. Number two, we maintain a global military presence, really unlike anything that the world has ever seen. And number three, we marry these global power projection capabilities with that global presence to support policies of global interventionism. That's the way we behaved when Harry Truman was president. That's the way we behaved when John Kennedy was president. That's the way we behave when Barack Obama is president. I just named three Democrats, but I don't mean that it's somehow a Democratic thing. In fact, there's a bipartisan consensus deeply rooted in Washington to sustain these habits.
Now, is one of the Washington rules also a commitment to a certain proposition, namely that any attack that might occur against U.S. interests must be essentially motiveless, and that to believe that there may be some motive is to hate America and you don't love your country and you just love the terrorists or you love the commies or whatever?
Well,
isn't
yes.
that
I mean,
something they're all committed to?
That there is this very widespread sense of innocence that if anybody threatens us or acts against us, that supposedly, like Pearl Harbor, it comes out of the blue. Of course, as a matter of history, Pearl Harbor didn't come out of the blue. Pearl Harbor really represented a ratcheting up of a competition between the United States and Imperial Japan that had been ongoing for decades, focused on who was going to control China, and more broadly, who was going to be the dominant power in the Asia Pacific. I think same thing could apply to 9/11. Americans persuade themselves that 9/11 came out of nowhere. In fact, it represented a response to, I'm not trying to defend it, it was a horrible criminal act, but that criminal act was a response to a set of actions on the part of the United States in the greater Middle East going back roughly a half century or more. We are not an innocent nation. That doesn't mean that we are an evil nation, but the unfolding of events, whether we're talking today about the putative crisis in Iran or our difficulties in Pakistan, unfolding events have a history. And it's a history which, when examined, certainly does not show us to be anything like an innocent party.
Now, you mentioned, I think, the key word here, which is bipartisan. Somehow Republicans managed to talk themselves into the idea that Barack Obama is some left-wing radical on foreign policy who's far outside the mainstream, and that's why we've got to replace this dangerous commie. But doesn't he seem to you to be basically just sort of a center-left variant of the Washington rules?
Absolutely no question about it. I mean, the notion that Obama is somehow selling us out when it comes to defense is totally absurd. I mean, my sense is that it's much closer to the truth to say that Obama has affirmed the revision of the Washington rules that occurred under George W. Bush than it is to say somehow he's gone off in some wacko direction. And what I mean is this. Bush's response to 9/11 was to embark upon an open-ended global war, the war on terrorism, as he called it. Bush's implementation of that war was based on the expectation that using U.S. military forces to invade and occupy countries, beginning with Afghanistan, moving on to Iraq, that would enable us to basically engineer fundamental change in the Islamic world such that 9/11 attacks wouldn't recur. That approach turned out to be disastrous, enormously costly, and not a lot to show for the lives that we lost, the lives that we ruined, and the money that we spent. Obama came in, and he said, I'm not going to do that anymore. And I think his contribution to this open-ended war has been to move away from the notion of invade and occupy and try to transform, and instead to embrace a different set of tactics embodied above all in the use of missile-firing drones and also in a greater emphasis on the use of special operations forces to do what are, in effect, hit-and-run raids. But when you step back and ask yourself, what constraints does President Obama recognize on the use of force? The answer is, like George W. Bush, he recognizes no constraints whatsoever. When you ask yourself, what is Obama's plan for victory? When is this war on terrorism going to come to an end? The answer is, like George W. Bush, he has no idea. It is, in effect, an open-ended enterprise. So the charge that Obama is weak on defense is absurd. I think the proper charge is that his approach is no more rational, is no sounder than was the approach that Bush conceived right after 9/11.
Do you describe yourself politically as a conservative?
I do, yes.
So now, do you... There's a lot we could say about this. I think we're getting to a point where conservatives who are skeptical of the Washington rules, the bipartisan foreign policy consensus, maybe we don't have to hold our conferences in phone booths anymore. But do you think that, number one, is there some perceptible shift in that direction? And if not, why is there this knee-jerk assumption by conservatives that domestically the government is a wreck, we don't believe a word they say, but when it's foreign policy, every word is gospel?
Well, I give a couple answers here. One answer, I think, is that if we held a big convention and invited everybody who called themselves conservatives, about 90% of the people who showed up would not genuinely have a conservative worldview. The people who write for and read the Weekly Standard magazine generally think of themselves as conservatives. That's, I think, absurd.
Yes.
So I think that that's point number one, is that the use of that term, conservative, has been so reckless and has led to such a profound misunderstanding that that coin simply has been devalued. Maybe we need to think up some other name around which, a label around which authentic conservatives can rally. The second thing is, the shift of opinion. I think that's where the Ron Paul candidacy is quite interesting. I said I'm a conservative. I have to say I'm not a libertarian. I really don't subscribe to the notion that deference to the marketplace provides the best vehicle to solving all our problems. I really don't think that a minimal state really is plausible in the world in which we have come to live. But I also wonder if the appeal of the Ron Paul candidacy derives from his being a libertarian or derives from his being an anti-interventionist, somebody who's skeptical of military power and its uses. And although I haven't seen any polling data, my guess is that it is the anti-interventionist Ron Paul more than the libertarian Ron Paul that gets a quite considerable number of people excited about his candidacy.
I agree completely. I want to develop that point on the other side of this break. You guys, it's Andrew Bacevich joining us here on the Peter Schiff Show, the gold standard in talk radio. Stick around. And we are back. Peter Schiff Show, Tom Woods in for Peter today, joined by Professor Andrew Bacevich of Boston University, author of numerous important books, most recently Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War, which I highly recommend you check out. Before the break, we were talking about Ron Paul and the extent to which it's his libertarian program in general, or particularly his non-interventionist foreign policy, that's driving his popularity. I think it's just a grab bag of different rationales, because he's the only one who will talk about the drug war or will talk about alternative health or raw milk. I mean, these are constituencies that didn't even know they would have a champion in politics. I think also it's the fact that he'll go to Florida and say, we need to trade with Cuba. Like, who's going to do that? Doesn't win him any votes, but he, I got to be me, the old saying. Now, what I want to ask you, though, is, although I'd love to spend the whole program talking about Ron Paul, believe me, I want to ask you, now, it's true that you can find plenty of Islamists who will not be appeased no matter what the United States does. On the other hand, there are a lot of just rank and file people who live in these countries who have been radicalized by the fact that they've been bombed or starved or whatever. And I think what's happened is that two things have happened simultaneously. Number one, over the past half century, there's been a great increase in the U.S. footprint in the Middle East. Secondly, there's been a great increase in radical Islam. And so it's hard sometimes to disentangle these two factors when you try to figure out what the motivations of anti-Americans in the Middle East might be. Given that, what would the President Andrew Bacevich approach be, given that there are some people who do want to do us harm?
Yeah. And of course, what I'm about to say, even if it has any merit, the implementation becomes very difficult because of so many decisions that have already been made that already have consequences that are hard to undo. But I think I would say about three things. The first is that the best defense is defense. I emphatically believe that the most important explanation for why 9/11 happened, in terms of immediate sort of explanation, is that we had our guard completely down. The government authorities had failed to take even minimally adequate efforts to ensure the safety of American airports. So 19 punks with box cutters could perpetrate this horrific crime. So how do we defend ourselves against the threat posed by radicalism? We do it by defending ourselves, by ensuring that we have the most robust possible defenses to keep bad people away from us. That'd be point number one. Point number two, I mean, you pointed to the sort of correlation between U.S. military presence in the region and the rise of radicalism. And there is a correlation, and I think that there's a causal relationship, that to some considerable degree, it's our mucking around in that region, even when we have good intentions, that leads to unintended consequences that are bad for us. So the second thing is, stop doing stupid stuff. I mean, do no harm. And I think that means radically reducing the size of the American military footprint in that part of the world. And then the third thing, I think, and here I'll make reference to the Arab Spring, we need to allow people to determine their own fate. I read the Arab Spring as a powerful expression of people in the Arab world who insist that they're going to be allowed to determine their own fate. We should respect that. And I say that without in any sense thinking that the outcome is necessarily going to look like Jeffersonian democracies or pro-Western governments, but we need to let them determine what their future is going to be rather than presuming that we know what their societies are supposed to look like, because our presumptions tend to be wrong.
And of course, nothing could be less conservative than to think that you could take some traditional society like this and put it through some kind of enlightenment ringer in 5 years.
I think you're exactly right.
Now, let me, given that we've only got a few minutes left, I can't believe the time has flown, and this is totally inadequate amount of time for you to expect you to do this, but can you give us your assessment of the Iran situation? What would you say to somebody who says, you know, we could deter the Soviets because the commies were atheists and they thought that, you know, they were just going to turn into dust when they died, but these people embrace death and they're just dying to blow themselves up and they don't care if they get incinerated? That's what most Republicans think. What do you say to that?
I just don't see it that way. I mean, to my mind, first of all, if you look at things from an Iranian perspective, and you should always look at the situation from your adversary's perspective, not because you're going to embrace that perspective, but because you want to understand why they do what they do. If you look at it from an Iranian perspective, they face very substantial national security threats, and we are the biggest one. So it's not unreasonable for them. It's not irrational for them to wish to arm themselves. And quite frankly, given what happens when countries like North Korea and Pakistan gain nuclear arms, meaning they gain respect, it's not irrational for Iran to seek a nuclear weapon. So it's not that this is some kind of a wacko proposition. The second thing I'd say is, if you look at the behavior of the Islamic regime, I'm not a supporter of the Islamic regime. I'm glad I don't live in Iran. But if you look at the behavior of that regime going back to the revolution, they have not behaved irrationally. They have not courted destruction. They have, in fact, I think, by and large, behaved relatively prudently. And therefore, I would argue strongly that they're likely to be deterrable. Just as we deterred the Soviet Union, we can deter this country. And therefore, the rush to war that you hear, I'm sad to say, among the so-called conservatives is, I think that's the irrational part. Among other things, it completely ignores the consequences of the last time we rushed to war because we thought some guy couldn't be allowed to acquire nuclear weapons, namely Iraq.
But what about, and here we've got just about a minute, but don't the Iranians want to kill all the Israelis? Wouldn't we have to? I mean, I'm obviously playing devil's advocate here.
No, I know. I mean, there is the vile rhetoric of President Ahmadinejad. There's also considerable evidence that Ahmadinejad does not really control Iranian national security policy. And I will be candid. Were I an Israeli Jew, I might have a somewhat different view of the Iranian threat. But I'm not an Israeli Jew. I'm an American, and I'm simply not keen on us involving ourselves in yet another war that I would strongly suspect would end up being as big a mess, or probably a bigger mess, than the wars we've already gotten ourselves involved in over the past decade.
Andrew Basevich, I knew the time would fly by. I appreciate you taking the time with us on the program today. Thanks so much for being with us.
All right, that's going to do it for today. As I say, I hope things will be back to normal by tomorrow, so I can release a fresh new episode. I've got a really great topic coming up because there's a really interesting new book on a topic that we're all interested in, and it's handled very deftly and skillfully. So I'm hopeful that tomorrow will be the day that we'll get to talk about that. So in any case, thanks for your patience, and I hope to see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.